Okay. Are you going to start?
All right. Give me your breakdown.
My spiel about why Die Hard is not only a Christmas movie, but one of the best, most theologically dense Christmas movies of all of them.
Yes.
Okay. So we were talking about this. There are three layers to Die Hard. There's the action layer that everyone knows about. Everyone's like, yeah, it's an action movie. But it's also a romance. Mm-hmm. And then it follows that it's also a theological, there's a spiritual layer. Okay. Mm-hmm. So
I'm trying to alliterate.
So the justification, you can do that.
I can't get the spiritual layer part. I got action, amorous. Aw.
Aw? Yeah, sure. Aw.
Okay.
So the first thing to understand is like the romantic side is in some ways the same plot that's happening on the action layer. It's just different focus, right? So, for those who haven't seen it, disclaimer, right? We're gonna give spoilers here, and it's not appropriate for children, right? Like you've gotten in trouble in the past for people thinking that you know this is a family movie. It's not.
But for the
record, action.
My 9-year-old child watched it.
Oh, really? Okay. So, yeah.
Well, and after you explain why it's one of the most, what'd you call it, theologically dense.
Yes. Did you see
it? That doesn't sound dense. Sounds. You mean dense good.
Theologically rich.
Rich.
Rich, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think once you explain it, at least some people, and I would be one of those people, would say, oh, it's like the Bible.
Yeah.
So is the Bible a suitable story for children? No.
Right. It's got a lot of violence and sex.
It's
Die Hard's
sure
like that. It's like the Bible.
R,
I mean, this is
in R-17.
This is my argument. Die Hard is like the Bible.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. So.
But good caveat.
Yeah.
Some people perhaps don't want their kids to read the Bible if they were being honest or certain sections of the Bible or watch that.
Just look at the parental guide in IMDb and figure out if you need to fast forward some parts. Yeah. So, so the premise of the movie, right, is you've got these terrorists who have taken hostages and at first people think it's just all about, you know, political reasons, like that they're trying to get in the Hans, the main terrorist guy, is like, yes, I want my comrades in arms in these other countries to be released. But it's really all about money, right? So it's important to focus on that when you look at the romance layer, or the amorous layer, sorry.
You can say romance.
Is that, and I don't know, I don't know. At first I was thinking, like, well, Holly is the terrorist, but maybe it's better to say, like, the pursuit, the false god of money and power is the terrorist on the romance layer. Mm-hmm. So John McClane flies out to California because his wife and his children are there being held hostage by the Nakatomi Corporation, essentially.
And by the quest for wealth.
And for the quest for wealth. Like, she could have stayed in New York and pursued her career, but instead she's moved to California. She's left her husband in New York, and she and her children are basically being held hostage by this pursuit. And at one point, they start to have a conversation, and she even says something like, you know, I know exactly what you think our marriage should look like. And he's like, you have no idea what I think marriage means. So, like, the same way the terrorist Hans is, like, doing this under the auspices for, like, political or philosophical reasons, but it's really about money.
Right.
I get the sense that Hollywood would say, like, I'm doing this. This is about, like, female independence and, like, this is about me having a career. It's like, no, you're doing this for money. And
because the Big Apple would afford her a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Until you brought that up, I had never even considered that, thought about it at all, but I think that's true.
All right, so...
Because she's a participant in this paradigm of terrorism.
Yeah.
The pursuit of...
I mean,
good career, but the premier version of wealth and climbing the corporate ladder.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so this is where I think the parallel is the strongest, right? Is like the same way the terrorists are willing to destroy the entire building and kill all these people in order to achieve their end, which is to get out of there with the bearer bonds. Like, she's willing to destroy her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And John McClane is coming. Same way he comes and enters the scene to thwart the terrorist plot of killing people and stealing all the money. Like, he's shown up to try and thwart the terrorist plot of destruction of his marriage and mm-hmm. the abduction of his children.
Right,
which we know will mess them up probably.
Yeah,
like they'll never. It'll take them a long time to understand. Like, why did mom leave dad to pursue this career, and what does that mean for my life? So, but to like go back to, you know, what is she doing there? I mean, I think her boss at one point, when John first shows up, he's like, "Oh, she was made for this business. She's tough as nails." And Alice is like, "Show him the watch. Like, show him it's a Rolex." Now this is really interesting. And without, like, so we're not talking about this for too long. This is where it really drives home that it's, like, it was more about, like, the money than just the power or the career, right? Is you go full circle to the end. Well, hold on. I'll go back to it. So John's there. He's there to save her. I think one of the other interesting parallels in that conversation that they had where it starts to get heated, it's, like, she's put him in a really difficult situation where my guess is it's a parallel to when John finds the detonators and the terrorists are going after him. And ultimately, like, they need the detonators back so they can blow up the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing you sort of see happen in that conversation with her, which is like she's put him into a situation where like he could just be like, you know what, fine, like
give this permission is more to blow it up.
Yeah, blow it up. Mm-hmm. Like he's holding the detonator, because at any point, like, he could, I mean, she's already made her decision, she's already committed to moving to California. It's basically up to him now. Like, he has the detonators to either blow up their marriage or try and make it work. And he's in that conversation, it's interesting because, you know, they start talking about their marriage and it starts to get heated and then it gets interrupted. And immediately afterwards, he's like banging his head against the door frame. He's like, stupid idiot. Like, why did I? Like, he's trying so hard not to blow up the marriage.
And trying hard to do anything that would contribute to her blowing it up.
Yeah.
Which... Yeah. Is, I think it's compelling that he's trying not to blow it up.
Yeah.
I think it's more compelling that he's committed to attempting to keep someone else from blowing it
up. Yeah. 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 So he's definitely fighting two battles, two different layers, where he's trying to stop the terrorist from blowing up the building and he's trying to stop his wife from blowing up their family, essentially.
Yeah. And he's doing it all from a position of weakness, and how do I want to say it?
He's not equipped.
But yeah, he's doing it from he's ill-equipped. He's doing it from a position of being ill-equipped.
Yeah,
yeah. Put the word weakness on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But before he's surprised by the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Of the terrorists, thematically, he's ill-equipped.
Yeah.
He's coming in from a different place. He's an outsider coming into L.A. He's coming in underdressed. He's coming into this corporate party, and he just looks like...
He happens to take his shoes off so he can make fists with his toes.
Yeah. He's what? A beat cop, basically. I don't know what version of cop he is in New York, but he's not FBI. He's not
anti-terrorism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's coming in ill-equipped in his relationship with Holly, because now he's on her turf in Los Angeles, and he's coming into, obviously, a...
in her office.
The whole action part of the story, which is yeah, he's not an anti-terrorist or even SWAT team guy. You know, he's not.
Yeah. Well, and probably most people, I mean, I think most people looking into that situation would be like, okay, you're a cop. That is not a really high paying job. Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, and it's also dangerous. And it doesn't, you know, you're probably not highly educated. Okay, here's Holly, who I'm guessing she's got, I mean, I'm gonna make facts up about her, but I'm guessing she's got like an Ivy League education. She's a working mother. She climbed the corporate ladder. She's basically number two in command at Nakatomi Corp, or the U.S. division of Nakatomi Corp. Like, she's clearly got it all together. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of just your average Joe.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and it's compelling to me that he comes in weak, and there are different angles on that weakness, different layers to it. So yeah. It's a robust picture of weakness. It's not simplistic. And then it deepens and it develops.
Yeah.
So then you get into the more deeper, in some ways more obvious motifs of weakness. So he's running around with an undershirt on, and eventually he has to use that to wrap that shirt around one of his bloody feet.
He's constantly improvising.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just having to use what he can find around him. And in terms of like the weakness and Holly's position of power relative to his, I mean, I also think I can imagine that if she had been successful in destroying their marriage, she would have looked like the good guy, because I mean, she took the kids with her. She's hired a maid / nanny to take care of them. She's making all this money. Like, she's going to be able to pay for their education. I mean, John does not have a plan.
Right.
So just another parallel to that is the terrorist plot is that after they blow up the building, they're going to escape in an ambulance. So they're going to put on the guise of the people who are there to help, the people who are actually can be trusted, and it's just their escape plan.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I can imagine if the McLean's marriage had been successfully destroyed by the pursuit of you know, wealth and power and whatnot, that people would have looked at it, and again, they would have been like, you're a cop and you don't really have much of a plan. You're good at improvising.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly your wife she's made a lot of valid points. Like, from our perspective,
mm-hmm.
she's the good guy. You're the one who's wrong.
Yeah.
And she's totally justified and right in doing what she's doing.
Yeah, which again makes it all the more compelling that he's coming into that.
Yeah.
Because so many people, if they saw the odds stacked against them like that,
yeah,
they'd say, this is a no-win situation.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way that he's going to get custody of the kids.
Yeah, and there's no way he's going to successfully be able to hold it together for himself personally. Back to your point about him beating his head against the mirror in the bathroom in Holly's office. So there's a dimension of his weakness where he can't even trust himself, really.
Because
mm-hmm. he's going to end up saying something that is going to perhaps detonate the relationship. Yeah. And then, furthermore, I mean, he can't make decisions for other people, and those mm-hmm. other people have all the power, all the control, all of the perceived right priorities.
Yeah.
And his willingness to fly to Los Angeles and enter into all of the uncertainties and variables and layer upon layer of weakness, that's really compelling.
Yeah.
And he's coming in, I think you're speaking to this as you're describing it, he's coming in as in one sense, a perceived bad guy. He's not the explicit terrorist bad guy, but he's coming in, if you really zoom in on Holly's perspective, it's, well, you know, cops aren't necessarily seen as just pure good guys. It's a thankless job. I mean, nobody gets pulled over by a cop and thinks, thank you for serving and protecting me. You know, it's like, why are you scrutinizing the way I'm driving. You know, like, why can't you just leave me alone? Yeah. And I mean, to your point, the villain's plan, the villain's are planning, the terrorists, they're planning on leaving as ambulance drivers, right? Yeah. That's different. So these are public service people, but there's a difference between a fireman and an ambulance driver and a cop.
Yeah.
Cops are viewed as, well, you know, cops can be
There's some people who are pretty supportive, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, no, sure. I get what you're saying.
Anyway, so John McClane's character embodies and epitomizes all of that.
Yeah. And yet he's there, or I guess the way the story plays out is, like, he not only defeats the terrorists who are, like, well-equipped and financed and have a plan, and they know that coming in, and he's completely caught off guard and doesn't have – I mean, he's definitely in a position of weakness. Same thing in his marriage, and he's there, but he's there. He at least knew he was there. Well, maybe he didn't know he was there to try and save his marriage. I think maybe he was there just
to show up for Christmas.
It's Christmas. Like, I want to see the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, actually, I had forgotten about this detail. So, like, the limousine driver is like, hey, man, if you score, like, if things go well, like, I'll bring your bags inside. And if things do not go well, I'll just basically take you somewhere where you can stay. And I think he's going to stay with his old buddy, police buddy.
Yeah, so he does like an hour have away. A little bit of a contingency plan.
He has a contingency plan.
But
he's basically not expecting. Yeah, and he's not going into this expecting to be a knight in shining armor, like rescuing his wife.
Yeah, that's really good.
And at the same time, he responds to the situation that he's in and ultimately does win her back.
Right.
So, spoiler alert, they end up back together.
Maybe that's the most accessible, immediately resonant theme of weakness is, can you enter into situations where you really are forced to wait and see and make adjustments as things develop? So even this... I would say a fairly obvious question if I'm John coming into this situation in LA with the estrangement from my family and all of the tensions is, do you have a pretty tight, pretty well figured out exit strategy, save face contingency plan? And the reality is he doesn't.
Yep.
One of the first things that develops early in the story is, lo and behold, the limo driver's actually a pretty cool guy who's willing to just in an improvised sort of way offer a suggestion as to a way, hey, this is how the cookie could crumble and here's how I can kind of be there to walk with you through that. And, but John doesn't know that guy coming into the story.
Right.
The
only person he knows is the person who is already an adversary.
Holly.
Mm-hmm. Has no friends.
Yeah.
He's complete lone wolf.
Yeah.
So let's pivot to the spiritual side of it. So, or the theological side of it, mm-hmm. or the awe side of it. So of course, we know and believe Ephesians 5, marriage is meant to be something that displays the mystery of Christ's love for the church. And so the whole point of John trying to rescue his marriage and rescue it from destruction by this enemy of, like, wealth and power and whatnot, kind of personified within Holly at the beginning, although she comes around. She starts to come around, I guess mid-movie, is that then it makes it more... So since the movie's about marriage is about Christ, you then start to see other things that are, they're all woven together, but I guess they're more explicitly representations of, I don't know, John McClane as a Christ figure in the film, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've already touched on some of these, but I guess just to draw the parallels between that and Jesus, I think you and I talked about this the other days. He shows up from another place. Like, he takes off his the garments that would have distinguished his person as a police officer, and he shows up in plain clothing, and no one knows that he's a police officer, right? Same way, like, no, Jesus shows up in first century Jerusalem and or first century Nazareth, and no one's like, oh, this is the Son of God.
Well, yeah. And what's interesting is that the people who do know that John is a New York cop, it's this limo driver who's stuck in the parking garage, seems to really have no power. I mean, first of all, he's oblivious to what's going on for the bulk of the story, and then eventually he finds out what's going on, and there's not a lot he can do when he first finds that out. And then Al, who's down on the ground.
Carl Winslow,
he knows.
Yeah.
But, he's got his own ghosts, and he's haunted by, his own storyline as a cop, and he can't bring himself to draw his gun on anybody anymore, and his wife's pregnant, and he's picking up snacks, and he's being mocked because he's kind of an overweight cop, and the guy at the 7-Eleven is saying, oh, you cops love your donuts, and he's not this big, like, iconic picture of power either. So it's interesting, the people who know who John really is are these weak, mockable characters. And when you look at the nativity, who knows that God in the flesh has shown up? Well, it's shepherds. It's it's these enigmatic astrologers from the East. So it's not King Herod.
It's not King Herod.
It's not the scribes and the people who study the Torah and have these elite positions in Jewish society. So it's interesting. Like, that theme is there in Die Hard. John shows up from this other place. He's laid aside his... He's not wearing an LAPD uniform when he shows up.
To add on to that, when Al intuits that he thinks this guy's a police officer, captain or like deputy chief of police or whatever is like, well, how do you know that? And Al, lists off a couple things that he said, and he's like, I've just got a hunch. And the person who is in authority, like same profession, same authority, so like AKA the Pharisees, is like, he's probably a terrorist. Like, the immediate conclusion is like, he's not on our side.
Right.
Like, he's actually the enemy.
Yeah.
Because if he was on our side, he would just get out of the way and let us do our job.
Right.
Which is exactly what the Pharisees did, right?
They're the people who should be most excited to be most on board with what John's doing are not on board with what he's doing. No. And they're actually villainizing him. They're saying he's actually part of the problem.
Yes.
And best thing he could do is to just let us do what we do.
Yeah.
Which is, the Pharisees want Jesus to do. Just get out of the way.
Yeah.
Maybe use some of your talent to support what we do, is the storyline with Jesus. But definitely don't assert yourself and run with your agenda. No, that's good.
Yeah. And I think that there are a couple of visual things, like the fact that John is walking around without shoes, without a shirt,
the bloody heel.
The bloody heel. Yes, right? You
the
brought that up.
The serpent will strike at your heel.
That's right. The broken glass struck at his heel.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many things. Could go on and on. I mean, this was something that I got really excited about when we were talking about this. And I had a feeling it had you convinced, but I was like, I'm not sure. Oh, we were talking about stickers, and we're like, what would be the sticker?
Right.
What would be the image? And I said, it should be like a scene from the movie where John is most Christ-like. And so I went and was trying to find, well, what is there a screenshot of like when he, at the end of the movie, comes around the corner to confront Hans and Holly and basically defeat the terrorists who are carrying out this plot to steal money and kill a bunch of people, as well as the terrorist who's trying to destroy his marriage. Like, he's confronting both of those in the same moment, and he comes around the corner and he's got a gun taped to his back
that no one knows about. And what is visually available to Holly and Hans is he's so bloody,
He's so dirty,
beaten up.
He's limping, yeah. And he's got a machine gun with no bullets in it, right? Yeah. And
so he looks completely beaten down and impotent. I mean, exactly. Whether they know the machine gun has no bullets, it's a worthless gun.
And it's right about 2 hours in the movie, so go watch this if you don't believe me. But he comes around the corner, and then the camera cuts to Holly's face. Mm-hmm. And what does she say the moment she sees him? What does she say?
Jesus.
She says Jesus. And it sounds... I mean, I've watched it, you know, however many times I've watched it, I always just think that that's like, you know, that's like taking the Lord's name in vain, because that's sort of how Jesus is used in most movies. Mm-hmm. But if it was a mistake, it's an amazing mistake.
Sure.
Because that is her response to seeing
this man. Well, she's saying it not from a place of gratuitous...
Yeah.
Cussing, taking the Lord's name. She's not. Yeah. She's saying it from a genuine place of shock.
Yeah.
Which, again,
maybe that's how they intended it.
Or yeah. Not. Well. I mean, I don't think the creators of Die Hard had this idea of, like, the high priest Caiaphas when he says things about Jesus, and then the gospel authors tell you. And in this way, Caiaphas, unbeknownst to him, actually prophesied something that was true. But I think that is what God does. He takes even what we produce as sin, what we contribute as sin, and he can orchestrate it for his own redemptive purposes. And I do think there's something more than coincidence about this, in one sense, very sincere statement of the name Jesus, even though it's not Holly saying, hey, you're a Christ figure.
Yeah.
But she's saying it from this place of genuine awe, I think, and shock. I mean, he's still alive, but she's also recognizing he is so beaten up. Yeah. He's so bloody. He is so frazzled. Yeah. But I can't believe he's still alive.
So stumbling on that caused me to go back and look, and there are a couple places where John like is essentially crying out to the Father, and then interestingly enough too, he and Al are on the radio talking to each other, and Al says something about, like, you know, if you are who I think you are, you'll know, like, when to do something, when to shut up, and when to pray, or something like that. Like, so the idea of, like, praying and calling out to God is actually in the movie in several places. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
So what's the sticker?
I don't know.
Would
yet.
The sticker be the picture of him all bloodied and beaten up, holding
the gun? I think holding the gun.
With the taped gun on the back?
Yes. Yeah. And you brought up I hadn't appreciated this, but you brought this up, and we chatted briefly about this before. What does he do at the very end, right before he... Like, he's in the position of ultimate vulnerability, right? Because he throws down. So he comes around the corner. Holly says, Jesus. And then he walks up. He throws the machine gun on the floor. It doesn't have any bullets anyway. But it looks like he's surrendering. Mm-hmm. And then what happens?
He laughs. Yeah.
Yeah. He and Hans have this little dialogue. And then he laughs in the face of his enemies.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he pulls out the gun. And then he had taped to his back. And he shoots the last two remaining terrorists.
Right.
Yeah. Defeats him. But that's not the end. And this ties back to the marriage aspect and the fact that both on the amorous level as well as the awe level or layers. The climax of the movie is right after that. Hans falls out of the window and he grabs Holly, and then what is the thing that he holds on to? And that's like,
oh, the watch.
Preventing it's the final straw before Hans dies, which is like
the end
of the terrorist era, from like the action layer. But it's also the Rolex.
Yeah.
That represents Holly's...
Yeah. And that is not a coincidence.
That is not a coincidence.
The creators of Die Hard definitely put that connection in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's this symbol of, like, this is what has been threatening to destroy your family. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that the...
This thing needs to fall to the ground and die.
Yep, exactly. Along with the actual terrorist. Mm-hmm. That scene and that idea of the symbol of this false god, that's got a grip on her life and their marriage.
Well, and you think about what a watch represents. It's a shackle.
Yeah.
You're in bondage to this quest for what you perceive to be the good life, prosperity, the status that you get from this career, and the fact that a watch is clasped around your wrist is an interesting image.
Well, and it kind of that final scene with the watch reminded me of there's a section towards the end of that Hideous Strength too, where I can't remember who's saying it, but they're at the is it Bellbury? Yeah, like the center for the NICE.
Uh-huh.
And there's some conversation about how like these demonic forces, like they just as soon like destroy the tools once they become ineffective. Mm-hmm. Right. So like Holly at this point there's no way she's going to continue working for the Nakatomi Corp. Like by the time John comes around the corner, like he's won her heart and she's definitely going to run back into it. She's going to run back into his arms. I have no doubt that their marriage has turned the corner at that point. Mm-hmm. And her career is playing second fiddle to this like just amazing self-sacrificial loving husband who.
Well, certainly they leave you with that impression when she has put her name on the door as Gennaro, her maiden name.
Yeah.
And at the end of the story, she's explicitly called Gennaro, and she corrects the person and says, "No, I choose the name McClane."
Yes, she takes back the name. That made me think of one other thing that reminds me a lot of Jesus is when. It's when the terrorists get the detonators back and John has to walk through the glass to escape that like gunfight. But Hans is like, we've got the detonators, we got to get back on plan. And so the one main terrorist guy whose brother gets killed in the beginning, who like just hates John with a passion, like comes back down and he's like smashing stuff. And Holly smiles and she's like, he's still alive. And her friend is like, what are you talking about? She's like, only John can make people that crazy. And it's like, that's so much like Jesus. Like only Jesus could drive people to the point of like insanity.
Yeah. So you brought up that guy and I'm not going to forget to come back to him a second. Did you finish your point about the demonic forces throwing their tools in there?
Just that like at the point where Holly has, she's going to leave Nakatomi Corp and she's going to go back to figuring out like their marriage because she sees John and she's seen what he's been through and what he looks like and all this stuff that he did essentially to save her. Like,
sure.
I mean, there's a part of me that thinks John would, I mean, and I haven't watched the other Die Hards in a while, so this is showing my ignorance or, and I don't know if those movies are any good compared to this, but Die Hard 1 is definitely...
That's all we're here to talk about.
This is all we're talking about. But yeah, I mean, like, how much of his just reckless abandon and willingness to go through all this stuff is, like, to save a bunch of strangers versus to rescue his wife.
Right.
I don't know. But my guess is
it's his wife.
Doing all these things to rescue his wife, given what we're seeing.
When he sees all the strangers, his first question is, where's Holly? Where's Holly?
That's true.
So he doesn't dismiss the other characters, but his priority is not the other characters.
His priority is Holly. And then he's like, get off the roof! And he starts shooting the gun, right? Like basically, and then gets misconstrued as a terrorist yet again by the FBI. Law enforcement officials. Where I was going with it is she's definitely, he's rescued her from the destruction of their marriage at that point. But the fact that when Hans falls out of the window and grabs on her wrist and he's holding on by her watch, that is like that section in The Hideous Strength where it's like, okay, like the demonic forces would just as soon like bring her to her physical death.
Right.
Now that she's no longer
right.
yeah. useful to our right. plot of destroying the marriage.
Yeah, like, just destruction for the sake of destruction now.
Yeah. 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 We were trying to break up their marriage and destroy this picture of Jesus' love for the church, but we haven't succeeded in that now that this Christ figure has shown up and done all these things to win back her heart. So we'll just kill her instead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That theme of really, I can't remember how Lewis puts it in Paralandra, but it's when the body of Weston, the unmanned, mm-hmm. is ripping open frogs and just mutilating frog and just leaving
yeah.
their corpses around. And it's, I can't remember how he articulates it, but it has that same theme of it's just mindless destruction. Yeah. There's no big, like, nefarious reason. It's just, this is what satanic forces do.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'll utilize things in some kind of shrewd, serpentine way for a while.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's just burn it. Yeah. Destroy it. Yeah.
Quick aside, I found that making references to the Space Trilogy, like, out of context for people who haven't read it, it sounds like such a weird story. Like,
it is, yeah.
like what you just said about ripping frogs apart. Yeah. Anyone who hasn't read that and listens to this will be like, what?
Yeah, maybe so, but I also know a lot of people who have, especially if they're boys.
I guess it also sounds weird that...
Well, know, especially if they're boys, yeah, they yeah. have stories like this. Their 7-year-old boy ripped the head off his sister's doll, and you ask him, why'd you do that? And there's something that... When I got to that scene in Paralandra where they're just
destroying for the sake of destruction,
yeah, killing frog. There's something in the wretched
yeah.
mind and in the world of sin where we see that. Right? Yeah. We see, why would you just destroy that? And yeah. you know, if you ask a 7-year-old boy, why did you do that? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know. Okay, so going back to the brother who.
Yeah.
comes down from the elevator and he's yeah. mad, and Holly makes that observation. Only John can make someone that frustrated. just out of curiosity, can we do anything with the final scene where, I mean, he's been hung by the chain.
Yes.
We think he's dead. No, apparently he survived.
Yeah.
Somehow he got down from the chain.
And what do you think?
Runs down, comes out just ready to, yeah. to blow up the world. I mean, going back to that theme of just yeah. destruction. I guess he has this vendetta against John.
Yeah.
And then that's where Al, you know, yeah. does draw his weapon.
Yeah.
I think the reason they put it in there was to give Al a redemptive moment.
Yeah.
To give him a sense, to give you this picture of, here's a guy who has this tragedy and he can't get over it. And mm-hmm. there have been some redemptive themes developing in the conversations that we've been privy to between
yeah.
Al and John, and they want to give you a little bit of a, hey, here's how the story kind of resolves for Al.
Yeah.
I think that's the reason they do it. But if you really just look at the terrorist guy, it feels a bit gratuitous. That was very forced.
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, maybe the on the spiritual layer. And again, I'm curious who wrote Die Hard, and like, were they thinking about any of this, or just all coincidence? Maybe it's just God, you know, intervening to make this movie so theologically rich. But I mean, maybe that's where we find ourselves today. Like, ultimately, Satan's been defeated. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Sin and death have been conquered by Christ. And yet, like, there's still demonic forces. There's still powers and principalities.
Right.
Like, we're still wrestling against.
Yeah. And there is
forces.
And there is a.
And Al to Al is the Holy Spirit.
Well, I had that thought just in terms of him as
a
voice in the story, and in the way he's a voice, because he's not in there with John.
That's true.
So if you sort of start to think about how we.
Yeah.
You know, we're united to Christ, or we in some ways, I guess, can see ourselves in the character of John.
Yeah.
We're talking about John as this Christ character. If you say, okay, well, what if you put yourself in John's situation? Al's presence in the story becomes very similar to the way God talks about the Holy Spirit. It's like, you're going to get this help, but it's not going to be it's probably not going to be the version of help that you had in mind. So the version of help I would have in mind if I were John is get me some people in here with me. And Al is not in there with him. He's on the walkie-talkie, and he's available for conversations. And he's available not really to give him tips, but to just be a companion, offer moral support, tell him to hang in there, or offer him a story of his own vulnerability and talk about how he can't draw his weapon because he had this really tragic thing happen in his life. And that's the form of help that we get from the Spirit and from Scripture and the stories of vulnerability and weakness. And so that's what he's offering, and that's very redemptive and profound, consistent with Scripture. I forgot what I was going to say earlier. The storyline of the guy who's still alive. It does have a shocking feel to it. Not just the story in Die Hard. That's obvious. Yeah. At least that's how I felt it when he comes out of the door. And I'm like, what? No way he's still alive. But yeah, you're right. I think you read Scripture and you say, so Jesus... heel is bruised, but he crushed the head of the serpent.
Right.
And so he dies on the cross. He says, it is finished. Three days later, he rises. So evil's been vanquished. And there are a lot of moments in the story after that and in our lives thousands of years later where you do have these experiences of what?
Yeah.
There's still pronounced...
Yeah.
Hard stuff and evil stuff and bad stuff, and it is kind of unbelievable sometimes, you know. And that's in a way how you feel when that guy's still alive and coming out of the door.
The evil that we encounter today, right, is a half dead version.
Well, and because we keep referencing the space trilogy, if you read Paralandra, that's how you feel. Yeah. There are these scenes when the unmanned, the body of Weston, is still alive. And you think he's dead. And no, he's still alive.
Yeah.
And then you think he's dead. And he's still alive.
Yeah.
So it's funny how Die Hard is a lot like the Space Trilogy as well.
Because they're both about Jesus.
Well, and Ransom has a lot of the same stuff that we noticed about John. Yeah. He's sent into a situation with no plan. The original story is... He has no clue what he's getting into. He's abducted.
Yeah.
And he's taken into this place where he plays a huge redemptive role, but he doesn't have any time to think about that beforehand. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
I will say that's probably like one area I didn't get to think about this too much. In anticipation of the conversation. But there definitely are areas where John is not Christ-like. As much as
Well, and that's true of every story in Scripture.
Right.
Of all the people who are types of Christ, pointing us to Christ.
Right, yeah.
All of them at some point are not like him. Yeah. So David is a type. Well,
yeah.
What about the sexual assault? Not. And what about the murder of Uriah? And, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, he's not in every way.
Yeah. But one for sure is that John is he's very much a reactionary, which I don't know. I mean, probably from our perspective, and certainly read Scripture, like the response of people around Jesus, they're like, "Does this guy have a plan? Like, we don't even know where we're gonna sleep tonight. Like, we're out here in the middle of the wilderness, and we don't have any food.
Right.
There are 5,000 people here.
Right?
What are we supposed to do? Like, clearly Jesus does not have a plan. Like, he's just
right.
And John is like that, 100%.
Yeah.
But I do think Jesus has a plan.
Right. But to your point, there's this interesting dynamic between where Jesus definitely has a plan, and yet it would be experienced by his followers. They would interpret it and experience it as, I don't think he has a plan. Yeah. And there would be some real... there would be some really... I guess I'll call them violent, like abrupt moments with Jesus where even he wouldn't be able, or he wouldn't choose, I guess, to speak to the plan. He wouldn't necessarily offer us a spelled out, mm-hmm. here's the rationale of my plan. And in some ways it's because of that theme in Habakkuk of, I mean, God is relentless about saying, hey, I could tell you the plan, but even if I tell you, you're not gonna believe it. That's what he says. He says, it, my ways are so different from your ways, yeah. that it's kind of inescapable that the plan is going to feel like, what's the plan here? You know? So some of the overlap with John and Jesus, you know, when John blows up the bottom floor, mm-hmm. Because what, they're shooting the missiles.
Yeah.
At the SWAT car.
That's right. Yeah. And he sends the C4 down the elevator.
Blows it up. I mean, that's maybe similar to Jesus rolling into the temple and flipping over tables and stuff. And people are probably wondering. I could picture Andrew or one of the more calm, steady apostles looking around and wondering, what is he doing? What's the plan here?
Yeah.
You know. And then the Pharisees and scribes are reacting very. They're upset with Jesus, and they say, "What gives you who?" Where do you get the authority to do this? Give us, what sign do you give to prove to us that you can come in here and just upend our system? And Jesus doesn't really offer them anything that's, at least it's not satisfying to them. Mm-hmm. You know, so it looks pretty reckless, in other words. It's like, what's the plan here, dude? You know? So, that's good.
All right, I think we should probably wrap it up because we're at 46 minutes.